Good vach, everybody, and welcome to Headlines. Well, we can't believe Yom Tov is over. It went so quickly. Just a few points. We don't say Tachnun because Rav of the Chodesh was Besimcha, so we don't start that again until Iyar. And some people are noig to be Magdim tomorrow Shachris a few minutes to put on their tefillin early because they've been without tefillin. Those who are not noig to wear tefillin Chol HaMoed for many days now. Well, this week our guest will be Rabbi Menachem Ginnack. And he's going to talk about a very contemporary issue. It's in using torture as a method of interrogation, which, you know, you have both what's happened in America in Guantanamo Bay and what they've discussed sometimes with terrorists, both here and abroad in Israel, etc., using tasers, etc. What is the halachic view on it? Next week, our topic will be another interesting topic, vaccinations in halacha. Our guest will be Rabbi Yosef David Bleich, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, the mechaber of the very, much used and popular contemporary halachic debates, the svarim that are, you know, very popular, etc. Also, tonight we have another special guest after Rabbi Ginnack, the famed psychologist, Dr. David Pelkowitz, who will be discussing another issue which is sadly very relevant today, and that is not the Aguna crisis, which thank God is, you know, fairly rare, but something that's sadly much more common, and that is the divorce crisis. We see so much of it. It would seem, even though there's no empirical evidence, that among the children there just seems to be more the concept of the disposable marriage. The social marriage where you can just turn it off and on like a Flickr page or like a computer. And what can we do both for, you know, the young people getting married today as well as, let's face it, you know, there's plenty of older people who are married who aren't doing so well. And what can we do to increase satisfaction in marriage and alternatively, or the flip side of it, decrease the divorce rate? So those would be our guests. You can listen to us on Talkline Communications, WMCA 570, or on the internet at WMCA.com or at NachumSiegel.com. Or we have another station that now started following us. It's 1640 AM in New Jersey, WJPR. So, welcome, Rabbi Ginnack.
Rabbi Ginnack, what would your opinion be if they caught an ultra-right-wing terrorist? Well, let's start in the most extreme case, where he had planted a ticking time bomb in a square in Tel Aviv for the purposes of making some type of a political expression. Would you say halachically torture would be permitted to elicit from him where the bomb is so as to save lives of onlookers?
Well, you know, before we address that specific case, well, just in general context, as Reb David mentioned, you know, we're not paskening shyly. This is, as he said, for discussion purposes only. But, you know, the thing that makes this so relevant now is because of the Feinstein report about the CIA and their conclusion, the Senate conclusion, in opposition to using torture as a means of gaining information from terrorists or from others. So, there are several issues that we have to deal with, which we're not going to deal with beyond our purview, but the Senate report suggests or claims, and this is a matter of complete dispute by the members of the CIA, certainly Vice President Cheney disputed it, but one issue is how credible is information that we get under torture, because people under torture can say all kinds of things. And then the other issue is, which doesn't probably apply to in this context, but is in general, is it counterproductive for our general standing in the world? I'm talking about the United States now. And is it helpful in terms of the battle that we're engaged in against terrorism? So we're not dealing with that in our conversation, but of course that is an important issue in terms of, you know, should we use, should torture be part of the tools that are in our toolkit in terms of fighting terrorism or not? Is it effective or not? So putting that to the side, having said that, in terms of a terrorist, as Dovah just described, where he set a bomb, we don't know where he set it, it would seem, at least it would seem to me, that it would, assuming that the only way we can get this information, it would be credible information, is through torture, that would be permitted. Because, first of all, we know there's a halacha, this terrorist himself, I mean, from two contexts. First of all, he's also obligated, l'osam el'adam riyacha, to protect other Jewish lives. And we, in general, by El Mitzvahs, we force people to do mitzvahs. Makanasho to Peche Nafsho, and Bezdin can force a person, presuming it's Bezdin, to, maybe that's an issue where it has to be necessarily Bezdin, but let's assume that it's Bezdin, that has to force him, can force a person, just we can force a person to take lulav, to put on tefillin, we should be able to force him to get this information. I should take Jinafso. Whether Teitzi Nafso means actually till he dies, or Ad for Adlo Bechlau, is a question in Poskim. Piskarov in his Kedusha Minoza says it's not Ad for Ad Bechlau. Chazanis was Masufka about it. Others think that it is Bechlau. So, but that would be permitted. The other issue in this very specific case, if he's the one who set the bomb, so he's a Rodef. And you can kill a Rodef to sell other people. So if you can kill the Rodef, you can use any means to get this information, presumably from him, to save the lives of the people who would be injured or killed because of this bomb.
So if he were not a, if he hadn't planted it himself, but he was merely aware of it, so he would not be a Rodef in that case, but it would only be also Samar al Damriyecha. It would only be else the obligation to save other lives. Is that correct?
I think so. I mean, offhand, if he has this information, but he didn't do it, he's not the Rodef.
So let me extend that. Let's say it was not it was not intra-Jewish, but it was an Arab terrorist who planted a bomb, and another Arab was aware of it, but was not part of that cell. Now this fellow does not have a mitzvah of lo samed al damriecha, does not have a mitzvah of hatzalah. What would be the means of getting information from this person who was aware of the ticking time bomb? It could be more problematic in that case.
It may be more problematic. It may still be permitted on several levels. First of all, it may be simply pikuach nefesh, for the just like Michal Shabbos for pikuach nefesh, it's an isa skila. You can be over on the isa chavala and so on that would be necessary to save other people. So pikuach nefesh of the other potential victims, and beyond that, we're right now engaged in a war against terrorists. Most of them, you know, nowadays a lot of them are within the Arab or Muslim world, extremists, fundamentalists, like ISIS, and Bashar's Milchama, in a time of war, extraordinary means are permitted. Whenever we go to war, we know that they're going to be korbanos, they're going to be soldiers killed on both sides. We know there'll be innocent victims in the war as well, and this is a battle that we're engaged in with the Arab world, so when Dine Milchama, it would seem that it would be permitted.
Now, in the case where it was a Jew who was aware of it, but who hadn't planted the bomb, could an argument be made that since he's not revealing it, he actually becomes a Rodef too, since he is not, because he can save other people, even though he was not complicit in planting it?
Maybe. I mean, in terms of Rodef, there are different kinds of Rodefs. There's a Rodef who's actually pursuing another person, attempting to kill him. And then there could be a Rodef even inadvertently and even if he's not doing anything. After the Gemara gives the case of Rodef, that the Rambam says it's based on the law of Rodef, that if a woman is pregnant and she's about to give birth, and the birth could kill her, that you're allowed to save the mother by killing the fetus to save her. And the Rambam says that's based on the halacha of Rodef. the Gemara says once the head has come out, so ein doche nefesh b'nei nefesh. Interesting, the Me'iri is of the opinion that's other people, but the mother herself can still save herself even in that case. This is a this Me'iri coincides or is in support of the position of the Mishnah Melech. Mishnah Melech quotes a position that this halacha by Lodet that you have to use minimum force, Yochel Atzil Be'ech Me'avavav, is only somebody else. But the Nirdaf, the victim or the potential victim, can save himself by killing the Vodaf no matter what, even if he could have done it in a, you know, in a different fashion, and if he could have shot him in the head, he could have shot him in the leg. But for the Nirdaf himself, it's permitted. But so we see in terms of the Uba, you don't have to actually be. But then, of course, the Uba is doing a particular action, you know, not consciously, it's being born. So if that's true, even B'Shevi Artaisa, maybe that would apply in this case as well. But of course, it's a little bit of a stretch because at least the Uber there—they're not exactly the same. Uber is—it's the Uber that's going to kill the mother, not without intention. So it is.
Uber is the missile, in effect.
It's the missile. I mean, in terms of this, it's worth reading this wonderful book by David Lichtenstein called Headlines. In a different context, he has an article about it. For example, what if there's a plane that's about the was a case of 9/11, a plane that was going to bang into a building and kill thousands of people. Would you have been allowed to shoot down that plane? By shooting it down, you're killing all the innocent people on the plane. But maybe it's permitted to save all the other lives. We know that, in fact, the United States, Vice President Cheney, who then, President Bush was not at the White House, he was out, and Cheney was in command to a certain degree. He had given instructions, if they could, to shoot down these planes. So an important reference for you to look at is Rabbi Lichtenstein's wonderful book, Headlines.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Ginnack. So Rabbi Ginnack, what would be the argument against using torture? If, indeed, in times of war, torture would be permitted, because a lot of the laws that of during a time of civilian peace are lifted, and additionally, for the purposes of saving lives, other laws are lifted. What would be the arguments against using torture? Like, we don't want to come out clearly on Dick Cheney's side.
Well, it would come back. The arguments, it comes back to the CIA report. The argument would be that maybe using torture, first of all, the question is how credible the information is, and how much, is the loss in terms of, let's say it was the United States in the context that we're talking about in terms of the support, did the use of torture, other countries know that we're using it, other combatants know, does that radicalize our enemy, and therefore instead of having 100 terrorists that we have to deal with, we have 1,000, and then we have to deal with how much information do we get, is it worth it? The bad effect in terms of radicalizing the enemy, as opposed to the value of this information. Now, the CIA report claims that when we caught Bin Laden, it was not based on the information that we got from torture. Was not, waterboarding and so on. That wasn't effective and didn't help us leading us towards Bin Laden. So that's a very practical question.
If you look at the news today, you see that the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, tweeted, "Look how humanity is being treated by dominant powers with their flashy propaganda in the name of human rights, democracy, and freedom." So your point is that when we torture, it causes, on the contrary, it comes back to us with plus interest.
Right. So then, but then the question is, maybe on a military basis, the information is so valuable that it's a trade-off. The question is, which is, and that's very much what's in dispute between Senator Feinstein and her members of her committee, the Democratic members at least, and those who dispute it. I mean, even if one would agree with it, I mean, one could also argue that it's not so smart to have let this report out. There's a cost to this transparency that, again, all this bad information is out, and it gives this Ayatollah you just quoted, Khomeini, the opportunity to cite a Senate report to, you know, confirm or affirm what he's saying.
So, Rabbi Ginnack, let me give you six or seven possible reasons to consider why torture should possibly halachically be problematic. Okay? One possibility is the possibility of Chilul Hashem, a profaning God's name. Many nations take the position that the Geneva Convention disallows torture in any situation. So, Chilul Hashem is, people die for Chilul Hashem. So would the concern of Chilul Hashem, even though it's halachically permitted, would that be a reason to disallow torture? Now, we know that there are many cases that halachically you are allowed to do something, but they're disallowed for the purposes of Chilul Hashem. We could cite many different cases like that. So the fact that it's halachically allowed is not a reason to say that it is not a Chilul Hashem. So would that be a consideration?
Well, again, I think it would be a consideration in the broad kind. I mean, let's just talk about Israeli policy in the war in Gaza. You know, we know that the Israelis, contrary to, you know, shamefully what the UN and these human rights commissions in the UN, which are, of course, populated by the biggest violators of human rights, Syria and others, were members of this commission. But Israel used in extraordinary efforts to avoid civilian casualties in Gaza. But the reason it did that was not only because of course, one was simply a human consideration, but it was also because of a political consideration. After all, war is just is a means of diplomacy by different means. So Israel is always calculating in also the plus and minus in terms of whatever it does. So in terms of Chilul Hashem, it would be Chilul Yisrael in the sense that if Israel were to use torture as an example, of course, Chilul Hashem in the American context is a little bit more difficult. But, that would be a factor, I would think, on a basis. You know, does it promote Israel's agenda and its standing in the world? But if up the halacha it's really permitted, the Chilul Hashem means that something that was inappropriate was done, and that's the Chilul Hashem. I don't know if the standard of Chilul Hashem should be the misconceptions of different governments or our enemies, but I'm sure it would factor in what would be the perception in the world and whether that helps or hurts Israel. For example, right now, we can be certain that in the Israeli foreign ministry and other places, they're trying to figure out, whether correctly or incorrectly, where does this put in this enormous chess game that's going on. We see, shamefully, that Europe has taken Hamas, at least they say for technical reason, but they've taken Hamas, this EU court, off the terrorist list. Many European countries have said in their parliaments that they're about to recognize Palestine. The EU voted about it last week. So how we approach these things, because those are very important issues in terms of where Israel stands politically in the world, economically, and those have enormous security ramifications for Israel. So for sure those are things that have to be taken.
So Rabbi Ginnack, let me ask you another question. Let me present a few more arguments to why torture could possibly be illegal. It says, the Gemara says that when you hang somebody, in an extreme case where somebody committed an act heinous enough to require the death penalty, immediately after he was killed, his body had to be removed from the body had to be cut down. He was not allowed to be left hanging. And the language of the pasuk is ki kill us alekim tali. The image of God is hanging on the tree. And we all know that man is made b'tzelem elokim in the image of God. And Rashi says, the exegesis on the verse says, it's like somebody whose relative is hanging on the tree. Every time they see it, cringes. So we see a concept here
that to desecrate any human being, it's a type of a desecration of the Ribbono Shel Olam, of God. Isn't torturing a human being, putting them through the most inhumane, disgusting, revolting, you read the CIA reports about the feces put in food, people kept awake for 150 hours with constant beatings, etc. Isn't that the worst invocation of Ki Kilas Alekim Tali, desecrating the image of God? Wouldn't that be a reason, and that would say, find another way to get that information from this individual?
Well, I think we all would agree that if we could find another way of getting that information, absolutely we should. And there is an issue of Tzelem Elokim, and death and torture shouldn't be used unless it's the only option. And as we spoke about with all the other caveats, that it's really effective, which is very questionable. So, in the example that you gave where a person is chayiv misa, they gave him skila and then they do tliya, so he's taken off right away. And there's always, the whole halach of kavod ames is a function of because of the tzelem elokim. That's why from that same halach we learn that kfuva has to take place in general, not only chayiv misa bez, and in general that we bury a person lo solin is also derived from there. So I agree absolutely. But it doesn't obviate if there would be a need to save people's lives, so that Tzelem Elokim is also significant. But of course, it's something that should only be used in extreme cases, and only if it's really effective. We know that the Gemara says that even when we give a person misa, some is chayv misa and is given a capital offense. Mochazal learned prolo misa yafa, that they should do it in the most, least painful and most, so to speak, aesthetic fashion. So that's even a person who's chayiv misa. Certainly, we would say that a person who's alive and being tortured, that.
Well, thank you very much, Rabbi Genack. This Yom Tov is a particularly good time for Hakaras HaTayiv. A lot of Pesach is about Hakaras HaTayiv to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But we know that it says in the Torah, Lo Sisayev Mitzri Ki Geir HaYisa Ba'artzei. We were guests in Egypt. Well, we weren't very welcome guests. And they didn't really do a very good job of taking care of us. I don't think slavery would be considered, appropriate accommodations for your guests. And yet, there's a mitzvah of Hakaras HaTayiv. So, Kal V'chaymer Ben B'nai Kal V'chaymer Afor Shiori. A person like Rabbi Genack, who's the president of the OU, who's the head of all the Rabbanis of the OU, I don't know his exact title there, but I know he's certainly the head of all Hachshirim, that if it weren't for Rabbi Genack, for most of us in America who are Eichlei Kashrus, who eat kosher, we would be eating the rest of the year just as we eat on Pesach, which I don't know what it's like for you, but in our house it's very minimal. It's potatoes and chicken and basically anything my wife can peel and squeeze. So he's really enriched and made so much more. If you're in business, like I do, I work very hard and I travel a lot. He's made kosher accommodations any place in the 50 states and beyond it as well. If you travel to the Caribbean, you can get OU products as well. So how much Hakaras HaTayiv do we need to Rabbi Genack and to the members of the OU, the Machshirim of the OU, who leave no corner of the world almost uncovered in their traveling and in the way they exert themselves, so that the Shomrei Torah mitzvahs, both here and abroad, it's very hard to eat something kosher almost anywhere in the world that the OU does not have its hands on one of its ingredients, its underlying ingredients. So we owe Hakaras HaTayiv, and I'd like to say thank you, and I would suggest to you all, the next time you see somebody from the OU who's a Rav HaMachshir or who's involved in the kashrus, has to say, thank you. You've made life for me and for my family, for you and for your family, so much more pleasant and livable. Thank you very much, Rabbi Genack. Our next guest is the world-famous psychologist and Oisik B'Tzarchei Tzibur Be'emunah, Dr. David Pelkowitz. Welcome, Dr. Pelkowitz.
Yes, hi. Pleasure to be here. Nice to talk to you.
So, Dr. Pelkowitz, we've had Reb David Cohn here a few weeks ago speaking about the Aguna crisis. And I've gotten a number of requests to speak about a different crisis, the get crisis, the divorce crisis. They said in the last 2 or 3 months, just in Lakewood alone, somebody said there have been over 30 divorces. So my question to you, is there a get crisis, or are there just more of us? It's just, you know, our Kanainahara, our population has really exploded. So percentage-wise, is there an increase in divorce?
Yeah, and it's an excellent question. Unfortunately, there's very little of any empirical research on what's happening to the divorce rate in the firm world. Impressionistically, though, there does seem to be an increase. Like if you ask almost anybody whether or not they know more people in their shul or in their community who are divorced than they did, let's say, 10 years ago, you're almost always going to hear like a perception of an increase in divorce, either in couples who have been married for 5 years or less, or in couples who have been married who are now divorcing after their last child leaves the home, you know, gets married and leaves the home. So there seems to be a bimodal distribution that way in those two groups. But that's more impressionistic, but I'm hearing it from communities all over.
So the question would be, Dr. Pelkowitz, what would you say is the causation for this?
So again, it's all speculative. There is one study that I was somewhat involved in, done about 7-8 years ago by Debbie Fox, and I was involved in it also, where we looked at a couple of thousand from couples around the United States. This was it was run out of Los Angeles, but it was a sample from all over the country. And one of the things that was asked is what was the main reason for divorce in the firm community. And there, it was very similar to what you see outside of the Orthodox Jewish community. It was conflict over child rearing, conflict over communication, intimacy, finances, and time, which is very, very similar to what you see everywhere in terms of the irreconcilable differences that, you know, people fight over money also, of course. In-laws, those were in the top of the list. But the deeper reason, I believe, is there seems to be a shift in expectations in the people who are getting divorced very, very close to the beginning of their marriage. It may be tied, or what I'm hearing very often, is people who went in without knowing each other very well. They don't necessarily have realistic expectations about what a marriage is all about, which is to stand at each other's sides through thick and thin. And there's a misconception that it's all going to be simple without having to work, without having to compromise. And sometimes in the earlier divorces, where it's happening within the year 1 to year 5, that seems to be a component.
The unreasonable expectations and not willing to work things out.
Right, and I wonder whether or not in some ways that's somehow compounded by people not necessarily really knowing each other before they get married, not really taking the time to understand how compatible they really are. And the world's become a little more complicated in terms of people tend to think more in black and white because of the internet and because of media. And very often there's a lack of maturity in terms of a failure to truly understand what divorce is, what marriage is all about. And also, there's interesting research that shows that once this starts to happen in a community, it actually becomes pretty contagious. So, for example, in a study done by the Pew Research Foundation a couple of years ago, they found that if your friend gets divorced, the likelihood of your getting divorced goes up quite a bit. In one very, very respected study, they found out that somebody is 75% more likely to get a divorce if a friend gets a divorce, and 33% more likely if it's a friend's friend. So when you look at it that way, it does tend, once it starts to happen, our community, which had been relatively immune, I mean, until relatively recently, it was not at all uncommon for a child whose parents were divorced to be the only child in the class or even in the school who has a parent who is divorced. And now it's beginning to shift a little bit, you know, where it's becoming, unfortunately, less of a rare event.
It used to be, my father, Zichron Levracha, used to see over Rabbi Yonis and Steif. He says, when we get married, we say, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael. Now, when we eat matzah, you don't say we're eating matzah, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael. We eat mor, we don't say Kedas mor. We don't eat the afikomen. We don't sit in a sukkah, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael. Put on tefillin, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael. Why by marriage do you say Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael?
Good question, yeah.
So Rabbi Yonis and Steif said, he says, how did Klal Yisrael and Moshe get along? Well, it says, Arboim Shana Akut Badair. For 40 years they fought. Did Moshe and Yisrael get separated? They didn't. So he says, when you get married, you say, Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael.
Very nice. Very nice, yeah.
I think I think that's
been a huge shift, is that people, you know, there's a study done by the OU and Yeshiva University that I was involved in to look at 4,000 marriages. And one of the things we found, which is very similar to what you find in the secular world, is that there's a U-shaped pattern to marital satisfaction. When you first get married, there's a very high rate of satisfaction. Shana Rishona, people tend to be very happy with each other, even though there's some challenges. Then, as pressure and stresses continue, the marital satisfaction rate goes steadily down, and it hits the bottom after about 15 years. And that's probably because you have teenage kids, financial pressures are greater, job pressures are greater. But then, if you stick it out, marital satisfaction slowly gets up in the U-shape, and it ends up, if you stick it out for 30 years or more, being even higher than it was at the beginning. So it's a matter of partly managing expectations. So this is what marriage looks like. There's a beautiful Tiferes Yisrael and Yevamos on the word Nisuin. He points out that embedded in the word Nisuin is a very important lesson, that the inevitable conflict between men and women when they're married can either be a masa, because the word masa is embedded in the word Nisuin, obviously meaning a burden that could weigh you down, or it could be a masa, which would either be a ness, banner or a miracle where you transcend it, or the word masa in Nach we often see means a nevuah or a song. So the very same conflict could be something that literally weighs you down and could end chas v'shalom ultimately in divorce, or it could be the source of growth. And when you understand that conflict in marriage is inevitable, and not only is it inevitable, it's often a source of growth, then people realize how important it is to stick it out if you can and hopefully be able to work it out. Now, sometimes, obviously, that can't be done, and that's why, you know, that's why there's a Maseches Gittin, that's why, you know, the Torah clearly allows it to happen, and there are times that it is inevitable. But very often, at the very least, people should go for help and look to work out to see if they can transform the masa's burden to masa's song.
Now, Dr. Belkowitz, it's, you know, the first mitzvah given to Klal Yisrael, many people would say is Achodesh Azalachem, but that really was given to Beis Din. So the first mitzvah given to Klal Yisrael as individuals was V'yikru Lachem Ish, Selabes Avay Selabayis, the family meal, the paschal meal which was eaten with the family, which seems to, intuitively, we sense that the Torah is telling us that the soul, the gravamen, the essence of Klal Yisrael is built around the family unit. Could you, as a professional psychologist, talk about what is, in your opinion, the importance of staying married so that the family unit stays intact, so that all that work should be, you know, is it worth it at the end of the day? I'm talking from a midrashic point of view, and I'd like you to talk from a practical, hands-on, as somebody who's Isaac Petarchet Tzibur. Is it true that keeping the family unit intact is indeed the most important building block of a person's essence, of their psychology, of their sense of self-esteem, of their productivity, etc.?
Yeah, look, I mean, from a just a very basic standpoint, the tavla mesav tandem ila mesav armalu, you know, that is just a fact from a research standpoint. People who are married, in spite of all the jokes, have a much lower rate of depression, for example, than people who are not married, people who are single. It's not so easy to live life alone and to live life without having somebody at your side to support you.
And let me just add on. I'm one of seven, so I have to interrupt. It's part of my. let me just say, in the Maisa Bereishis, it says six times Toiv, and it only says one time Lo Toiv in the entire Sheish Yemei Bereishis.
Lo Tov Heyos Adam Levado Es Elohei Zirkanecho.
Right, Lo Tov Heyos Adam Levado. So just to buttress your point.
Right, exactly. And I really, you know, it's almost such a truism that it doesn't even need to be talked about, but it's true that families as a unit tend to do much, much better. But there is a caveat. If children, for example, are growing up in a home, and people are growing up in a home where there's constant fighting, or chas v'shalom, where there's even violence, or where there's emotional abuse, or where people are really fighting in a way that is frequent and dominating and is not punctuated with a lot of closeness, but really where what dominates is open conflict, especially if it pulls kids in the middle, and where both people are miserable and they try to work it out and nothing is working out, there it may very well make sense to realize that, okay, this is why there's the option of divorce built into the Torah. But as the default setting, boy, is it worth fighting over. You know, most people underestimate the emotional cost of divorce, the financial cost of divorce, the impact on children who often are pulled in a very, very difficult way that could cause lingering kinds of impact on them. And I think very often people are surprised after they make the decision and are on the path towards, you know, getting a get. Having a divorce go through, they're often surprised at how emotionally wrenching it is and how devastating it is to everybody involved. But again, there are times that there's no option. But people should think about it extremely carefully, I think. And even if it doesn't work out, I believe if to go to a competent marital therapist and to be able to, at the very least, let your children know as they get older that you gave it your best shot. They need to know that you really tried to preserve the family, because otherwise they're going to understandably have time to say, why didn't you at least try?
Now, in your opinion, as a family therapist who's seen conflict, do people who go through divorce afterwards, years later, do many of them regret it? Do they think maybe, you know, they were sold the line of goods that the grass is greener on the other side?
Some do. Some do. I think there's some studies, really interesting studies. I remember seeing a study that said that a year or two after a divorce, a surprisingly high percentage of people said, if I had only known, I would not have embarked on this. But again, after the first 2 years are extremely, extremely difficult for both sides and for the children. But then, look, if it's inevitable, the resilience is the norm. Very often, after two or three very, very difficult years, people start to build a new life, very often are able to find new happiness with somebody else, and they're able to, according to the research, if children are then exposed to a quieter home and are no longer exposed to fighting between their parents, because sometimes the fighting gets even worse after the divorce, so then kids are even worse off after the divorce than before the divorce. But if somehow parents are able to provide the kids post-divorce with stability, and they're able then ultimately as a family to move on to the new normal and to the next stage, then things really can in some cases get better than it was before, or at the very least to stabilize in a way that there's a whole new life that could be rebuilt.
Now, Dr. Pelkowitz, in your opinion or in your experience, the knee-jerk reaction to many couples who have issues is to go to a Rav. Many Rabbanim, I would say the vast majority, are not trained therapists. Is this a wise or an unwise move?
You know, the study I was talking about before that was done by Debbie Fox in California, the Atlanta Family Counseling Center that I was part of, one of the questions she asked was, how happy are people who go to Rabbanim with the experience of going to Rabbanim for help with a troubled marriage, and how happy are they with marital therapists they go to? So, unfortunately, people aren't always so happy with marital therapists either, but a far, far higher percentage of people were satisfied with their Rav. A very high percentage of people did not find going to the Rav to be particularly helpful. Now, sometimes a Rav could be extremely helpful in terms of guiding and in terms of supporting and in terms of encouraging. Chas v'shalom, I don't want to say that there's no role for a Rav at all, but I think that if it's a really troubled marriage that's on the brink of ending, I think every couple owes it to themselves to go to somebody who has professional training in doing marital therapy. Marital therapy is the brain surgery in some ways of counseling. It requires a lot of training. It's extremely challenging. And there are some techniques and approaches and ways of approaching couples that really can give people a shot and sometimes can be quite successful. Without that training, I don't know that a Rav could be as effective as somebody who's trained. It's just common sense. Sometimes you could have a Rav and a therapist work together in partnership. But I think as a rule of thumb, people who have a very troubled marriage owe it to themselves to, in addition to seeing their Rav and working with their Rav, they owe it to themselves to go to a professional who spent years learning how to help distressed couples.
So you say that the study showed that people who went to therapists had a higher satisfaction rate than people who are far higher than people who went to Rabbanim.
Right, although interestingly, and this is just as a caveat, in some of the large-scale studies of satisfaction with therapists in general, so let's say you compare somebody who goes to therapy for depression or for anxiety or for trauma or for all the different reasons people go to therapy, the lowest level of satisfaction of all the kinds of therapy people go to help for with well-trained therapists is marital therapists, because it's more complicated. You know, when you have two in the room, it's much tougher than when you only have one in the room. So I'm not saying it's always going to be perfect, but in that comparative study that was done by Debbie Fox and me, there was, we found a significantly higher rate of satisfaction with the professionally trained marital therapist than with the Rabbanim in terms of helping with the marriage.
Now, as parents, I mean, this is a three-pronged question. As parents, as educators, which I'm not, and as husbands and wives, and our spouses, what can we do to create happier marriages? I mean, among our children, lower, you know, what's the education? How do we educate our children? If you're an educator, how do you educate, you know, your class or whoever your body of your disciples are? And as individuals, who everybody needs work, you know, it's on marriage. How do we improve our marriages?
So I think the single most important thing from a chinuch standpoint, from an educator standpoint, is first of all to help young adults know, people who are beginning to think about getting married, to know what predicts success in a marriage and what's nonsense. There's a lot of nonsense out there in terms of silly things that people look for that predict absolutely nothing. Sometimes people call off a shidduch because of what they perceive as some kind of like slight difference in hashkafa or slight difference in silly things that predict absolutely nothing long term. Might be a slight difference in dress and in religious values in ways that are really subtle and don't really predict anything long term at all, because, you know, Frumkeit and spirituality is something that changes over time. People hopefully grow over time. So you're always going to be growing together as a couple, so slight differences are probably not going to predict big problems at all. What does predict a marriage, and what does matter, is how do you handle conflict together as you get to know each other? It's sharing a similar vision and dream. It's people who bring out the best in each other, people who are similar in terms of interest. You have to really enjoy the person. It's a myth to say that opposites attract. You don't have to be identical. You want to complement each other in terms of not just with an I, but with an E. You want to bring out the best in each other. But you want to think long term about being able to enjoy each other's company and become each other's best friend. There was a fascinating study done by a researcher at Cornell who interviewed, I think it was 1,000 people who had been married for 50, 60 years, and asked them, what did you learn from your years of marriage? These are people who are successfully married. And among the top answers that were given is that the physical attraction is not at all important over the long term, although a basic physical attraction is obviously important. But what really matters long term is to give 100-100, meaning you get away from the idea of giving 50-50. You want to be able to grow through only thinking about how do I give to the other person as opposed to how come he or she's not giving me what I should get. So giving 100-100 is excellent advice that these thousand old people say that they learned over many decades of marriage. And the other is to try to marry somebody who you think could eventually be your best friend, somebody who you think that you're going to be able to really enjoy being with. You have to enjoy their company, and you have to be better because of them. You have to be able to grow because of them. And you have to be able to manage conflict well. Sefer Hasidim wrote many centuries ago three words that capture this. Achris ketata charata. After argument, there's regret. And sometimes you could see that early on, before people decide to get married. Is this somebody who can't handle conflict? Is this somebody who stays angry for a very long period of time? That's not a good sign. Is this somebody who I could really eventually enjoy being with after I really get to know them? That's one piece that I wanted to focus on in terms of how we could educate kids, is to know what to look for. The other is to manage expectations, is to understand that marriage in many ways requires learning how to sacrifice, learning how to manage stress together, learning how to work things out together, and not getting all upset and running away from working on the marriage because of the inevitable conflict that has to happen after the initial thrill wears off, you know, after the first year or so of marriage. So I think those two things, you know, that list that I just went over, coupled with managing expectations, that's what I hear from colleagues all the time who are marital therapists, is that there seems to be a problem where people don't understand that fighting is part of marriage. And just one more point, and then I'll be quiet, is that there's a famous marital therapist who says marriage is a people-growing machine, meaning that we grow through the conflict. We grow through the conflict. There's inevitable disagreement in a marriage, but it's through that disagreement that we actually learn and grow and become better. We usually end up having to struggle with working on the very issue that you need to work on anyway. So if you're always fighting with your wife because she feels that you have a temper, that means you really have to control your temper and work on it no matter who you're married to and no matter who you're spending time with. And if the other side of the couple, you're always fighting over her, let's say, being late, so that probably means that she has to work on being more punctual. And marriage brings out those issues in a way that makes you into a better person anyway. So even after a divorce, you're going to have to work on those issues with whoever you end up with on a second marriage in any case.
So let me review. You say the first part was somebody similar who you can build a friendship with. And just, you know, to, you know, it's interesting that in the Sheva Brachas we say, we talk about Chasan, Kala, Ahava, we talk about love, but then we say, Ahava, Achva, Shalom, Vareyas. Achva is with a wife, brotherhood, harmony, and friendship, all of which seem to be based more around friendship than you know, conjugal bliss, right? We have Ahava, but then we have Achva, Shalom, Vareyas, brotherhood, harmony, friendship. Which seem to be. So you're saying one part is definitely about somebody who you can be a friend with, somebody, therefore, who also brings out the best in you, and somebody who handles conflict well. In other words, who, when they argue, they recognize that it's a normal part of a relationship, and how do we resolve it in a respectful way, able to listen to each other. That's on one list. And the other side, you say, is managing expectation. And I want to ask you on that point, do you think that the world that we live in today, where everybody we see in the news has been photoshopped, no matter what you look like, to somebody who's taller, better looking, has more hair, better teeth, is smarter, has a bigger Rosh Hashiva, everybody in the news is photoshopped. Do you think that all, you know, the generation of consumerism, of this unrealistic, you know, portrait of what marriage or people are supposed to be like in the news, has that sort of corrupted our visions of what the... I think I once heard from you, you said there are all the normal people and there's everybody else that me and you know.
Right, right. I had a professor would say, there are two kinds of people. There are normal people and there are people I know.
Do you think that visage that we see just bombarded with us in the internet and the newspapers, and has that sort of created expectations that are just not tenable in a relationship if we take them to be true?
Absolutely, and I think so. Some of it is coming from the general culture. So, for example, they're really what's seeped in, even if we're living in a community that's not as exposed as the general community to media out there, I think there's something in the culture out there that creates unrealistic expectations about, first of all, how people should look. There's the myth of the instant soulmate, which 90% of Americans subscribe to, and we know as Jews that's not true. We know that marriage is built over time and a life of decades of mutually giving to each other, like I said before, that giving 100-100 with the hava vahava. So that's absolutely, I think, a huge component. And then there's even within our community, and there's the Facebook impact where people only present their best selves on Facebook or other social media. But I think even outside of social media, there's a tendency to only show a certain amount of perfection. Dr. Yitz Schechter, together with one of his colleagues, I wish I could quote her properly, did a fascinating study where they asked, if I remember correctly, they asked a group of men, of young men who were going out, who were looking to get married, what their ideal description was for physically for a woman that they'd want to marry. And everybody said, you know, Sheker Echen Chein Vehevel Yofi, I'm not looking for somebody of a particular weight or particular appearance. But then they looked at the weight of a large group of women in a certain from neighborhood. You know, so it was a very large number of people. And they tracked their weight, the weight of these young women, and the number of dates they had in a given year. So even though these guys said they don't care, they were only going out with women who in this study they found were not only of normal weight, but in some cases significantly underweight. So that's just on that level, that there is a tendency to put even certainly as much emphasis on appearance as the secular culture does, even though we don't own up to it. And that predicts absolutely nothing about the success of a relationship. We know that. It predicts nothing. you know, what predicts are the things that we were talking about before. And I think that, that the outside culture has very much seeped in to our culture, and the Internet puts it on steroids.
So if you had to give a closing, like a closing mimer to our audience and say, you know, you want your children to have happy marriages, to stay married, give it to us in a bullet.
Yeah, I think focus on what matters. Focus, think for yourselves, those of you who are lucky enough to have a good marriage. What are the core ingredients of success in your marriage? When are you feeling most connected to your spouse? And my guess is it's when you're sitting around the Seder, when you're sitting around a Shabbos table, Yontif table, when you're sharing together in being with each other, where you're giving each other attention and support and living a life of shared values. And think about, as you prepare your children to figure out who they're going to marry, think about looking for somebody who captures those core values that have to do with success in marriage. And it's not going to be about appearance. It's not going to be about the financial. It's not going to be about silly kinds of minor differences on a shidduch resume that predict nothing. It's going to be about the enduring ingredients of happiness, which has to do with the ingredients that we've been talking about for the last half hour.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pelkowitz. It's an honor to have you with us, and I hope that our listeners take your words to heart, and hopefully we can have a tiny little impact on the divorce rate.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, thank you all for joining us here on Headlines. Next week's topic will be vaccinations. What's the halachic view? Can you elect not to vaccinate your child? Or are you maybe being a negligent parent, or maybe worse, being Oymed Loisamed Al Dam Riecha? A school, does it have the right to say, if you don't vaccinate your child, we won't accept your child? Or alternatively, are they obligated not to accept a vaccinated child? What is the halachic view of this hotly debated topic, hotly in some circles? Our guest will be Rabbi Yosef David Bleich, who's the Rosh Hashiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and an author of many Sfarim, contemporary halachic issues. And it will be a very big honor to have him on our program. The following weeks, we will be having Reb Herschel Schechter will be speaking on the concept of bankruptcy. What is a halachic view? If somebody owes debt and they put their business into bankruptcy, well, does bankruptcy erase personal debt as well, or can you then be summoned to it entirely? Because in halacha, at least in the Shulchan Aruch, there is no provision for bankruptcy. So we would like to thank you all for listening. And again, we would like to express special thanks to Dr. David Pelkowitz. Do you know that when in davening in my shul, when they say, V'chol mishoyskim b'tzerchei tzibur b'yamuna, Dr. Pelkowitz is certainly one of the foremost people that has to come to mind. He has given so much of his energy, and he speaks to all the communities. He speaks in Yeshiva University, and then I see him in Monroe and Satma, and then I see him in Square, and I see him in Borough Park and in Flatbush and in the Five Towns. He is truly the psychologist with the rainbow glasses. He accepts everybody. And he only has one desire, and that is to be mar b'shalom, achva v'reyos, and problems in his community, in the greater Yiddish community. So a special thanks to Dr. Pelkowitz. Thank you very much. I look forward to speaking to you all again next Matzah Shabbos.